Progressive Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. Tonight, I have a very special guest with me, a listener to this program who has corresponded with me, Dr. Charles Ellis. You may recall the July 12th Heretics Hour, just 1 month ago, when Eberhard Fuhr was my guest. I should pronounce his name correctly. It's Fuhr, not Fuhr. Eberhard was interned for about 5 years and not released until September 1947, along with his parents and brothers because they were German nationals living in the United States, and the United States was at war with Germany. The U.S. government to this day refuses to acknowledge the internment of Germans and Italians, as it has the internment of Japanese. But Charles told me of another group who were interned during that war, and most of us are not aware of this. And it's a very interesting story, and that is the people I'm talking about are the Aleuts from up there on that Aleutian Islands, who are and were American citizens, as far as I know. What is of interest here is the way these people were treated by the U.S. government, which, of course, advertises itself then as now as the good guys who treat their citizens right. So, hello, Charles, and thanks for coming on the program.
My pleasure.
Okay, well, it's certainly a pleasure of mine. I understand that you're grounded right now by bad weather as you were flying from one place to another. You sounds like you have an exciting life. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Well, the main thing I do is I'm a psychiatrist, and my specialty or subspecialty is transcultural psychiatry. When I went to medical school, I decided to specialize in that, so it gave me an excuse to do what I really like to do. Anyway, so I trained under some of the leading transcultural psychiatrists in the world. And then after I got out of my training, I was really tired of big cities, so I moved to Alaska. And I've been up there for 20 years, working for a lot of different agencies in the state, and, working with a lot of different cultural groups up there. And that's how I ran across the story of the Aleuts and how they were treated by the U.S. government. And then when I was listening to you... We're talking about the interned Germans and Italians, it made me think of the Aleuts and how they were treated.
So that's how you pronounce it, Aleuts. My goodness,
yes,
I was saying Aleuts, what do I know? That's interesting. So that's the Aleutian Islands, huh?
Well, the Aleutians.
But we call the people the Aleuts, huh?
Right, yeah, it's customary. I don't know how people wind up getting called what they are, but... That's quite a story in itself, but save that for another time.
So what do you do as a psychiatric doctor up there? Do you deal with the Native American peoples?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They're about a third of the population, so they're about a third of my caseload. I'm what they call a biological psychiatrist. I treat people with drugs. I don't really do much psychotherapy, and I treat the depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. And things like that.
And do the native people have this more of a problem with depression and drugs, or not?
Well, I mean, yeah, they definitely have a bigger problem. I mean, it's historically any culture that has a novel drug introduced to it will immediately have an epidemic of it as it sweeps through the population and weeds out the people that are susceptible to it. You can go back in England in the 1600s and see woodcuts when they first learned how to distill hard liquor. Most of London was drunk. And they actually, that's when the first laws against distilling came into effect to save the population. So the same thing happened to the natives when they could make mild alcoholic beverages already, but when they had hard liquor introduced, it was an epidemic, just like it is in any culture. So at this point, since they've only been introduced to it for a couple hundred years, it's taken a real toll on them.
Why are you saying that when people become more accustomed to alcohol, say,
right,
over many centuries, they build up some kind of a resistance or defense towards it?
No, it's clearly a gene that makes you susceptible to extreme intoxication or addiction to any chemical. So the people that have that die out, don't reproduce, and the people that don't have it reproduce, so that fewer and fewer people become alcoholics. I don't think any particular culture is more susceptible, except only depending on the length of time they've been exposed to the chemical. Because of what I've said, I mean, some people have a receptor that makes them very susceptible to the effects of alcohol. And if they have that, they tend to die young from alcoholism and they don't reproduce. So fewer and fewer people in the population have that gene, and so more people do not become alcoholics as the years wear on. And so, I mean, it's a biological problem. It's a genetic thing. And there are other people who take issue with that, but I think the evidence personally is overwhelming that that's what's going on.
Okay, now, you have sent me some information, but I think it would be better, or of course, much better if you tell us about it. So what happened to these Aleuts during the war, and how is it similar to what happened with Eberhard IV and the Germans?
Well, I'll just give you a real quick synopsis. The Aleuts initially lived in the Aleutian Islands, but sometime back in history, and I'm not exactly sure when, the governments, either the Russians or the United States, the Russians or the Americans, transplanted a bunch of Aleuts up onto the Pribilof Islands, which we call them the fur seal islands, because they're inhabited by, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of fur seals in these huge rookeries. And really, only the Aleuts know how to harvest them, because they've been doing it from time immemorial. So it became a government monopoly, and they had Aleuts living on those islands, and they were basically wards of the state. In fact, they were not citizens. They were literally wards of the states, and for practical purposes, they were slaves, because they were supported by the government, and they worked for the government, and the government made an incredible amount of money off the fur seals. There are also Aleuts lived all up and down the Aleutian chain in the Aleutian Islands. But the problem is when World War II broke out, the Japanese made a feint for Alaska, the Americans got worried that the Japanese would capture the Aleuts and put them in concentration camps. So, of course, the Americans, to save the Aleuts, rounded them up and put them in concentration camps in the United States.
Yeah, right.
So, anyway, it sounds like the cure was...
Were they like officially citizens, but they just weren't given rights? They weren't treated very well? Or were they actually somehow...
No, they were not citizens. And they were wards of the state. In fact, actually, every Alaska knew about the concentration camps and the way they were treated and stuff like that, because when I first went to Alaska, I lived in Juneau, and one of the concentration camps is just right outside of Juneau. But what I didn't know until I actually sailed into St. Paul Island in the Pribilofs, and it happened to be on their Independence Day, and it was in the end of August, the 1st of September, in that time period, and I was a little surprised when they invited me to their Independence Party. And I didn't want to point out that, Independence Day was July 4th, because, but then they could see the look on my face, and they said, no, it's our Independence Day. It's when we got independence from the United States, and that was like about 25 years ago, when they finally became independent and weren't wards of the state anymore.
Well, what do they mean by independence? What are they?
What are they? They're free American citizens now, and they own their own island, and they run, you really have to, you can read up on it, but they were not citizens, and basically they were chattel property of the United States government.
Well, how many of these Aleuts were involved in all of this roundup? 881
of them? Yeah, that's right. That's the number. I'm going from memory now, and I hate to do this, but...
Nine villages.
Nine villages. They rounded up like over 800 people, men, women, and children, and they put them in about 5 different concentration camps strung up and down the southeast Alaska. And about 10% of them died from disease, malnourishment, exposure. And I'm kind of speechless when I think about it, because when you realize that the American government in the 40s was taking in about $5 million a year off the fur seal trade, and that's $5 million 1945 dollars, which is probably about $50 million nowadays. And yet they couldn't find any money to actually feed these people that they had put in these camps. They didn't feed them. They didn't give them adequate clothing. They didn't have adequate medical care. They didn't have clean water. They lived in these old abandoned canneries or mine buildings. And then, to add insult to injury,
you said that they had in Funter Bay cannery barracks. Right. They had no sewer system, no laundry, no bathing facilities, no electricity, no heat, no windows or doors. I mean, there are holes in the roof, it's just really terrible. But you had told me that this was the women and children living in these places, and they had the men somewhere else continuing to harvest the seal furs.
Right. They were so worried about the Aleuts that they rounded them all up to save them from the Japanese and put them down in these camps in southeast Alaska. But you got to remember, the Aleutians are a very different environment than southeast. Southeast is a temperate rainforest where it rains 90 to 120 inches a year, a subarctic rainforest. Whereas the Aleutians, they're just windswept Arctic islands, but the climate is fundamentally different. And they weren't allowed to bring their clothing. Everybody just packed a little suitcase. So when they got down to southeast Alaska, they were basically in their BVDs, and they really weren't given adequate clothing or anything else. But then they decided it was time to harvest the fur seal. So then they rounded up all the men and shipped them back out to the fur seal islands so they could harvest the seals. So these guys are out working for the government, collecting $5 million for them, which they weren't paid for. While their women and children were starving back in Funter Bay and the other places, which seemed a little odd to me.
So the government was collecting all this money. They got the fur seals, and they had some business in it. How does the government do business like that? Do they have some special agency that took care of that, and they were taking in all that? They got the furs, and then did they sell them? How does the government do that?
They get the seal. They get the furs. Because only the Aleuts really knew how to harvest them correctly and, tan them or prepare them. And, all that, back in those days, everything was made out of furs before artificial fabrics, and definitely before, naga hide, stuff like that. Right. So it was very valuable, and all that high fashion stuff, fur seal coats, shoes, handbags, you name it, there's a tremendous demand for fur seals. Because that fur is really thick and, makes good, makes good clothes and stuff like that.
Curious, yeah. So, those lovely little seals, well, it's
right.
A horrible thing. But, and then here they had these people who were doing all this for them, living in this really terrible conditions. And was anybody complaining? Was there any kind of, were these
people the Aleuts were
to speak up for themselves?
The Aleuts were complaining. Well, actually, maybe that's not even true, because that culture, they don't complain. They're tough people, and to live in that. Actually, I like the Bering Sea. I think it's one of the most beautiful places in the world. And if you dress properly, it's great. But to live out there for hundreds or thousands of years, you got to be tough. And so, and they're a culture of not complaining. So when they were treated in this abysmal condition, they generally didn't complain about it, and they never really complained until the modern victimization age started, and everybody else was clamoring for recompensation. And these people have been sitting there quietly for 40, 50 years, and finally they decided they had a just cause. So they're just starting to have it acknowledged.
Well, there weren't that many of them, compared to these other groups.
Right, they're not a big voting
block. How many thousands of Japanese were there? And there were several, 11,000 German and Italian combined,
right,
who were interned. Right. So here we've got, not that many, but it does say here that 32 died at Funter Bay Camp, 17 at the Killer's New Camp, 20 at Ward Lake, 5 at Burnett Inlet. A lot of, some of these were children. I mean, this was, it wasn't just people dying from
medical. The people that died were the old people and the children. You know, and I mean, yeah, the numbers are small, but it's, you know, it's the hypocrisy of the whole thing that gets me. You know, people are constantly whining about, you know, our favorite ogres, and yet, you know, our government turns right around and does the very same things to people because they're basically helpless and they can get away with it. And we don't hear a word about it. And so that's what bothers me about this whole thing. It doesn't matter that, well, only 30 of them died. It's a, you know, why in the hell did 30 of them die in the first place? It was totally unnecessary. Our rail lines weren't being bombed and, you know, our food supplies weren't cut off.
Point was that this, our government could very well take better care of these people, and they didn't do it. And why do they say now that, something went wrong, or what do they say? What do they say? Oh, it was just one of those things that fell through the cracks or something. You know, they always have these excuses. But obviously they knew what they were doing. And there's a picture here of all these people being taken on the ship. They look like nice, well-dressed people. You know, I mean, they're not dressed fancy, but, you know, they weren't a bunch of vagabonds. Right. And
they're not.
Treated like that, my God.
You know, everybody's trying to blend in and you know, get with the program, and the thanks they got for it is... But mainly, the only thing the government was worried about is making sure their first seal operation wasn't interrupted. First, they didn't want the Japanese to interrupt.
The reason they say they did this was because they were afraid, as you pointed out in the beginning, that the Japanese were going to come and capture these people. So they were supposedly protecting them. But really, as you were now you're saying that their real reason was to save their first seal program.
Right.
To keep it going.
Right. That's why they rounded them all up, because they didn't want the Japanese to capture the Aleuts and make them hunt the fur seals for them. And, you know, so they had to move them back to the rear area so they'd be, quote, safe. And then to show the callousness of the whole operation, they took the men away and to go out and hunt the seals. And they did this on a regular basis for the entire war.
Sent back to their home right after the war ended, or did it take a while? Or were they ever sent back?
No, they were sent back. I can't tell you exactly when they went back. It's it's easy to look up. Anybody can do a web search. There's a whole slug of sites about it with a lot of information I didn't know about until I heard your show and went back and started digging out a lot of the details. I mean, I was even more horrified when I did that than from the original story I heard when I got to Alaska years ago.
Well, of course, it's good to publicize things like this because our government is so hypocritical, and as we know, they're trying to point to other people as bad people all the time.
It's hypocrisy. I mean, you know, it's like we have the approved enemies and the approved victims, and everybody else can go, you know, please step back. So, I mean, that's what bothers me. I mean, when people really dig into it, they find that the American government was just as brutal, just as vicious, and they did it on purpose. So I have a hard time believing anything they say about other groups that they want to victimize or blame stuff on.
Very well put. What has happened? Has Congress passed a resolution saying have they apologized to these people, or have they, you know, got some compensation?
They are now, but the only, I mean, I'm going to be, hey, call me a skeptic, but the only reason that they've now got compensation and acknowledgement and stuff is because victimization has become popular. I'm suspicious of the people that are rushing up there now to help them, because they deserve reparations, I think. But what I'm saying is they wouldn't even get that if it hadn't become popular, right? Nobody gives a... The truth is nobody gives a damn about the Aleuts or anybody else unless they can make a buck off of them.
Well, they had to once it was brought up, and they had, you know, you say, they've been apologizing to everybody, so they do that. And it couldn't have cost them too much because there's not that many people involved. So what are what are these Aleuts doing now? Are they still kind of a people together? And are they still harvesting seals? furs and so on, or what do they do?
Well, that's a kind of a funny question to me, because it's like one time when I was in Canada and I asked some guy in a restaurant what people around there did for a living, and he just looked at me and he said, "Oh, we just work." So, you know, the Aleuts are like everybody else. I mean, they're anything from sea captains to, you know, the garbage sweepers and anything in between. You know, you got to the villages and they've got, you know, harbor masters, mayors, politicians. A lot of them are, you know, fishing boat operators. In fact, a lot of them actually have their own fishing boats in that business, because that's a cultural business they've been doing for hundreds of years. And they're actually incredibly, they call them highline fishermen. They're incredibly good fishermen because they know where the fish are and they know how to get them.
What comes to my mind is, do they have their own communities still, or are they pretty well integrated, or is it half and half, or what?
Well, I mean, there's two trends. One trend is to assimilate into the dominant culture. Is their culture. Most people I know, most of my friends, it's just, you know, they just strike a middle road. They adopt the things from the Western culture that are beneficial to them, and they hang on to the things from their own culture that are beneficial. So it's a really mixture.
Well, I'm reading some of this material you sent me, Charles, and there's a documentary that's been made. And, of course, it's on public broadcasting stations. They've gotten into it because, as you say, you know, this is a nice victim story for them. But still, these people have a real complaint. And it says here, how did this happen? They've asked the question, you know, how did it happen? And it says that, well, it happened because they thought that these people wouldn't notice what kind of conditions they were living in. That's, you know, see, they thought, well, they're kind of primitive people, so we just put them in these primitive places, and they'll never know the difference. And then it says that, the conditions in Funter Bay defied even that, substandard conditions. So they said, here's a log from the daily life that the camp bosses kept. It says, July 19th, 43, every man, woman, and child in camp is sick except for me and the cook. And then the next day he writes, every man, woman, and child is sick except for the cook. Now the agent is sick, and the next day every man, woman, and child is sick in camp, period. You know, and on it goes like that. So, and it says that federal fish and wildlife agents were in charge of the Funter Bay camps, but somehow they were more interested in the seal hunting operation than anything else. Oh, here's something. The first gathering of internment survivors didn't come until the 60th anniversary of the bombing of Dutch Harbor. Now, Dutch Harbor is up there around Alaska. Among those who came to Unalaska for the event was a Jewish woman who'd survived the German concentration camps. And she'd become a grief counselor and invited internment survivors to meet with her. La, 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 la. So there we go. This is PBS stuff. Well, okay. It says here, I see that the title of this one article, Evacuation and Internment, 1942 to 1945. So as soon as the war was over, they were released from that situation they were put in, unlike the other groups.
Right. Yeah, I don't know exactly, but I thought I read somewhere that they were sent back pretty quickly, simply because they needed to be back at the fur seal islands to hunt the fur seals. And yeah, once the Japanese were eliminated, keeping them locked up wasn't really an issue.
Well, there are a lot of memorials now in that area to these people and what happened to them and right. To the ones who died. And so now it's all, you know, being recognized and so on. I appreciate that you have brought this story to us. It tells us more about the way the U.S. government treated its own people during World War II in its war frenzy, you might say, or whatever, about the big enemies that they had. So,
right.
So Charles, thanks a lot, and I appreciate it, and we'll say goodnight now, okay?
Okay, hey, thanks a million. I really admire your program. I listen to it. I listen to every one. I got them on my iPod.
Well, I hope you enjoy this one. Thanks a lot,
Charles. All right, take care.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back after the break.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Russia's foreign ministry is accusing the U.S. of failing to comply with key arms control and non-proliferation requirements. According to the new report published on the ministry's website, Washington's lost over 1,000 nuclear materials on its own soil. It's also being accused of ignoring some points of the old Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty with Moscow, which expired last December. The U.S. has allegedly kept in service several missile silos it was supposed to scrap under the deal. Other allegations include experimentation with chemical and biological materials banned by the U.N., and claims Washington's actually been selling weapons to Iran. So far, there's been no official reaction from the United States. All right, well, political analyst Vladimir Kozin now joins me to talk further about this. Good to see you, sir.
Thank you very much.
What can you tell us about the timing of these reports and allegations surfacing now when the New START treaty is awaiting ratification? Why now?
The beginning came when the Republican Party of the United States of America decided urged the State Department to produce a report which appeared under very long name, compliance of the Russian Federation with a number of arms control treaties, etc., etc. It appeared for general public on 28th of July. So the next day, the Russian Foreign Ministry just refuted this allegation and said that everything was baseless, lack of facts, etc., etc. But having said that, the Russian Foreign Service decided to counter-offer something in the form of a report which appeared today. And the timing is very simple, because it's a very serious paper. We have to verify every figure, the name of the organization, persons mentioned there, violations, etc., etc. So it definitely took some time for the Russian side to prepare such a high-caliber report.
All right, so if I may jump in here just briefly.
Yeah.
The report claims that the U.S. has been selling weapons to countries that it blacklisted, for example, Syria and Iran. Could there be any explanations and any ground, any basis for this?
Yes, it's a double-standard policy. For example, they are urging Russia not to sell S-300 missiles, anti-missile system, to Iran. But at the same time, they are selling the same kind of system to other countries, Patriot missiles, not prohibited, by the way, by the international law. But at the same time, they are selling man pads or portable anti-aircraft missiles called Stinger to a number of countries. 15, 17, that's very bad.
It's a
violation of a special regime prohibiting selling such things to other countries all over the world.
So if I may jump into the report, though, there are also claims here in this report that American companies have lost nuclear materials. Some reports suggesting some 1,500 radioactive elements have been lost over a few years, some even stolen. How worrying is this fact?
Extremely alarming fact. Because it could be disseminated, it could be a result, it could come into the hands of terrorists and other just bad guys. So while just labeling other countries that they are not vigilant in terms of these matters, but at the same time the United States are turning blind eye to their own experiments with this kind of thing. So that's why the Russian side has made accusations for 8 international regimes, conventions and treaties, and 1 bilateral, that's a former START 1 treaty, which already elapsed. But nevertheless, the thing is very serious. And it happened, it should have happened a long time ago, I think. Mm. So we have been waiting. But nevertheless, we see that there is no breakthrough. Violations were kept going, etc., etc.
That's right. Now, I mean, certainly the two different reports coming out, one report from Washington, one from Moscow, this potential game of tit-for-tat, bit of mudslinging going on here. We'll have to see how it plays out. Vladimir Kozin, political analyst, always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. The theme of internment goes on and on. The truth about how this small group of Aleut people was treated by the U.S. government in time of wars is even more unacceptable because they were such a small group. In this case, you'd think the wealthy and powerful U.S. government could find some decent lodgings for them. Instead, they were dumped into abandoned canneries, a herring saltery, and a gold mine camp called Duration Villages, meaning, I guess, obviously for the duration of the war. And this is just another example of how the Allied democracies are so good at coining nice-sounding names for, and even noble-sounding names for, ugly events. One thing that I don't think got mentioned when Charles was on was that food, it was mentioned in his articles about this place, these places, that food was so scarce that many had only one meal a day. I don't think this was really the best United States government or the U.S. military could do. They certainly had enough food to give to these people if they wanted to. I think they just ignored that. I think they forgot all about them. They just dumped them in there and then let them manage on their own under terrible conditions. But my point here is, and I think Charles' point really was, to compare this with the conditions of German camps that I have described to you on this program in the past, the real conditions, not the lying propaganda put out by the communists and Jews. In this case, the Germans come off better than the Americans. In my opinion, they do. Even with the camp conditions that Eberhard Fuhrer told us about in Crystal City, Texas, in Ellis Island, New York, they were no more than equal to what the Germans had. This is truth. And we are being had by the mass media in the New World, Jew World order to see the Germans, especially under Hitler, as far worse than they ever were or ever wanted to be. While at the same time we're given an image of America, Britain, and Western European nations is far better than they were or wanted to be. To illustrate how this deception can so often pass under our radar screens, I want to tell you about a most interesting message that was posted just a couple days ago on an internet discussion group. I'm not going to mention the name of this group or the name of any of the people, but this group is made up of people interested in improving the image of Germany and German culture throughout the world. In other words, to overcome the negative stereotype since World Wars I and II mainly. But they insist on being politically correct because they feel that they are especially vulnerable. Now, how this works is that on this discussion group, there aren't very many Jews, but there is one Jew who comes on regularly and is quite abusive, and quite vehement, and name-calling if he feels it's necessary, and defends what he sees as Jewish interests to the hilt. So I would say on this group, Jews are allowed to say whatever they like, as they are throughout the media, the world, society as we live in it today. But here, if other members post anything that is anti-Jewish in the eyes of Jews, not in the eyes of non-Jews, that's frowned upon. So somebody posted something that this Jew that comes on took umbrage to and got all upset about and wrote something very abusive to this person about it. And so the moderator, who is British, a British citizen, there are quite a few Brits and Canadians in this group who are interested in being nice to Germany. But they are very, you know, they distinguish very much between the Third Reich Germans and the Germany that they want to defend. So I'm going to read you an excerpt from what this moderator wrote after this person. Somebody wrote another comment following that. The comment that the Jew got all upset about. Somebody wrote, he decided to write to the group as a whole, and he called it a gentle reminder. And he wrote within that very long message this: the sort of thing I'm talking about includes comments which could be perceived as racist, discriminatory, or indeed anti-Semitic, as well as potentially abusive verbally to others. Although I don't see much of a difference between anti-Semitism and racism, the former is vehemently protected by those who still seek to collectivize, maybe even demonize, the German people. In large, due to what we do, what we stand for, and who we are vulnerable to attacks labeling us anti-Semitic, fascist, neo-Nazi, incorrect, racist. Not only are these labels and accusations incorrect, but they are counterproductive in an era of global human rights and as such are potentially deadly for our group. Once gained, such labels are extremely difficult to get rid of. In essence, he is saying that we have to be especially careful not to upset the people who put out these labels, who put these labels on others. He doesn't say we are here to defend against these kind of labels and we should not tolerate these labels. They don't take that position. Their position is we must be very careful in what we say and how we present ourselves so that we do not attract these kind of labels to us. So, following that, either the same person or another one, I'm not sure by this name here, wrote the following message, which I thought was very good, and I'm going to read it to you in total. He wrote, "Dear moderator, regarding your gentle reminders about freedom of speech and opinion, I am the son of a German immigrant who was interned by the U.S. government during World War II. I grew up in the 1950s. So for starters, my father and his entire family were treated unfairly by being imprisoned merely because he was German. But that was something that he never wanted to talk about. To this day, the U.S. government has not even acknowledged that it even happened. I personally have endured a lifetime of slights and remarks made by individuals expressing their hatred for the German people, including being spat on when I was maybe 4 or 5 years old and being called a Nazi. So I have grown up very sensitive to being slighted for being German. And let me tell you, the slights have never stopped. But they are very subtle, even subliminal, nevertheless, still ever present. The latest example I can give you was during a telecast of World Cup soccer. One announcer didn't know, he says, I didn't know his name, but one announcer said after Spain won their game to be in the final against Germany that, quote, the Netherlands really wanted to play the Germans, though, to get revenge for a little thing called World War II, unquote. I sat there absolutely dumbfounded with my mouth hanging open. So I can't even watch a sporting event without what? A reminder? A slight? A degrading remark? And yet, on the other hand, I guess I have, and he puts in all capitals, no right to freedom of expression. I am supposed to just take it. Take the high road. Be the better person. While all the while my rights and feelings are trampled upon, all the while being made to feel guilty for something that happened before I was born and for which I will always pay some price, always being afraid to say something out of fear of being labeled, demeaned, degraded by people that somehow or other had every right to do that. So I sit here now feeling for the first time ashamed to be German. Not for the reasons that most of the world thinks we should be ashamed, but for the fact that the once proud German race is now reduced to a race of kowtowing cowards, sycophants, and apologists forever looking over their shoulder, gutless, politically correct zombies awaiting annihilation by the mere specters of an immutable past and a hopeless future." Now that's the end of his comment. Now, I think he was referring to the members of this discussion group he's on. And the post sent out by the moderator, the gentle reminder. But these people didn't seem to get it because they followed up by commenting in a kind of camaraderie with him, and they understood how he felt and all, but you know, they didn't see that they were those people. They thought he was speaking about other people. So my comment on all this is that I'm shocked too by that comment from the sports broadcaster. And I asked this: can you imagine if he were talking about any group other than Germans, what trouble he would get into? But Germany and Germans are still considered fair game, and the prejudice is not allowed to go away. Some examples of this. One, every former Axis country, of the Axis nations of World War II, has signed a peace treaty with the United States, except Germany. Germany is still considered too dangerous to be allowed full sovereignty. As we know, Gunter Deckard brought it up last week, that Germany doesn't have a real constitution. They've never been allowed to have their people vote on their own constitution. They have a law that was given to them by the United States called the Basic Law. That's still what they're under. And since there's no peace treaty, they're still occupied, and they can still be held accountable for what was decided at the end of World War II. You know, that has not been finalized. They've not been set free from that. Number two that I think about is that among the interned populations in the U.S., it's only the Germans, and of course there are a smaller number of Italians that were bound up with the Germans, that have not been recognized as such, apologized to, and compensated for their losses. That internment of the German and Italian population has never been recognized by Congress. Two of the largest selling books of all time are The Diary of Anne Frank and Elie Wiesel's Night, and both are dealing in stereotypes of ugly Germans who victimize innocent people in the so-called Holocaust. These books have been made compulsory reading in high schools and colleges. In fact, Night has been translated into 30 languages and sold more than 6 million copies in the United States. Isn't that interesting? They put it that way, more than 6 million. Now, both The Diary of Anne Frank and Night are works of fiction, and yet they're promoted as fact, and evidence to the contrary is just shouted down. In some places, you go to prison for suggesting they are fiction. But if it were allowed to be proven that they are, it could be, because it can be proven that they're fiction. In fact, that's part of what I'm working on with this new Elie Wiesel Cons the World website. Now, I finally read Night. I admitted on this program a while back that I had never read it, but I thought, oh, I don't know if I can stand it, but I did finally read it. And it wasn't too bad because I had already read Irene Zizblatt's The Fifth Diamond, and you know, this book, The Fifth Diamond, is like on a sixth grade level or something. And really, Night is not any different. I mean, it's no better. It's the same. He's a little bit more poetic. His poetic, I guess, passages are a little better than hers, but not that much. Not. I didn't feel it. I thought, this is what drivel. What drivel this is. And I'm not alone in that. The former editor of Harper's Magazine, I have found this in an article by Alexander Cockburn, who does not think like I do, but he did put this. He did write a pretty good article, has some good stuff in it about Elie Wiesel. And he has this in it, that this former editor of Harper's Magazine, Lewis Lapham, delivered a lecture at the University of Ottawa to the Graduate Students Association. And after the lecture, there was a question and answer session, which was televised by CPAC, Canada's Parliamentary TV channel. And in response to an inquiry about the decline in the quality of education, Lapham replied this, and I'm quoting, "I have had three children. My youngest is now 25. My eldest is 32. They all went through a very high-end American secondary schools and colleges. And the syllabus of books that they were given in the English courses were terrible. I mean, they were all tracts. There was a big fuss about Oprah Winfrey and the James Frey book, and she's now going to put her on her TV show, Elie Wiesel's Night. This is really one of the worst books I have ever read, and I've had to read it 3 times to my 3 children, and it's junk. But it's the kind of junk that has become very de rigueur in American universities. It's a propaganda poster with the kind of books that kids are given to read. I mean, it would turn them off books forever. No wonder, because they're being given tracts. And the big subject, of course, is victimology. And yet, I don't think this man is Jewish. But all over the media, everywhere, everybody agrees that this is a great book, that this is a stunning book, that this is such a literary book. But people who really know better. And this man was willing to tell the truth about it. Now, another thing about Knight, there was a famous scene about Knight's truthfulness, because it has come to my attention that Elie Wiesel insists that every word in Knight is true and factual. It's a factual account of what took place in Auschwitz, Birkenau, Monowitz, Buchenwald. And I always thought that he acknowledged that it was kind of half fiction, because the book came out originally as fiction. Now, here's another thing from Cockburn's article. He was speaking to Raul Hilberg. And Raul Hilberg, you know, the famous Holocaust historian, he was talking about this scene. There's a scene in Elie Wiesel's book, Night, that in which three prisoners are hung, and the rest of the prisoners have to watch this hanging of these three. And it was 2 adult men, and 1 was a child. And, of course, this child is really was a teenager who was some kind of an assistant block leader, but who had gotten into actually done some illegal things. But in this genre, they always call these teenagers and adolescents children. So now he's a sad-eyed, angel-faced child, and he's being hung in between these 2 adults. And the fact is that this is like all these, like so many of these little anecdotal scenes that are in the book, they're just made up. They never took place. It's just all fiction. And Raul Hilberg says, I talked recently to a survivor of that section of the camp who said the hanging of the three, didn't take place. But maybe it took place earlier. Well, if it took place earlier, he's just saying he wouldn't know, because when he was there, it didn't take place. But he was there when Elie Wiesel supposedly was there, so that doesn't mean anything. Raul Hilberg says, dating these things is hard for survivors. Oh, yeah. Some have doubted this would have taken place. Buna was a work camp, so this other survivor, a PhD in history and a very intelligent man, didn't believe it. Well, this man's doubt about it will never be heard by the masses, even if he wrote up his denial. Even if he was brave enough to do that, it would be suppressed. Now, there's another fellow that he writes about, another survivor, Elie Pfefferkorn, who at the time of this article was 77 years old. He's about the same age as Elie Wiesel. He lives in Toronto. He's originally from Poland. And he eventually came to the United States. He taught, and it says he spent some time working with Wiesel on the conceptual design of the Holocaust Museum. I mean, he's very much into survivorship and Holocaust. But still, he says that he was once an uncritical admirer of Wiesel's, but now his opinion of Wiesel is not favorable. And he goes, there's a whole lot. He's writing a book, I guess. He's going to tell all these things. But there's one particular passage where Pfefferkorn says, in 1981, Wiesel invited me to give a talk to his seminar students at Boston University. In the course of my talk, I discussed the relationship between memory and imagination in a number of literary works. I then pointed out the literary devices he used in Night, devices, I stressed, that make the memoir a compelling read. Well, most people talk about the literary devices used in Night to make it a better piece of literature. That's how they explain all the nonsense that's in there, because any intelligent person can see what nonsense it is. But now here, Pfefferkorn continues saying, Weasel's reaction to my comments was swift as lightning. I had never seen him as angry before or since. In the presence of John Silber, the then president of Boston University, and my own Brown University students, whom I had invited, he lost his composure, lashing out at me for daring to question the literalness of the memoir. In Weasel's eyes, as in the eyes of his disciples, Knight assumed a level of sacrosanctity, next in importance to the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. In terms of veracity, it is a factually recorded work, according to Weasel. Virtually meeting Leopold von Ranke's benchmark of historical accounts, how it really was. Well, this is the insanity of it all. This truly is the insanity. For those who think that, as I said before, that Weasel accepts that there is a lot of symbolism in Knight, no. In the new translation of 2006, which is what I'm reading, he goes up against those who say that it is not absolutely true. He says it is. And what he's going by here, I don't know. This man is nuts. And we live in a world of where insanity rules. This is all there is to it. We live under the rule of insanity. And it is just as insane to hang on to this anti-German bias that so many are infected with as it is to believe in this stuff that Elie Wiesel is promoting. There's no real basis for it, none. It's just propaganda and madness. So I want to tell you all that I'm going to be on a guest on a someone else's program this coming Wednesday. It's The Real Deal with Jim Fetzer. And he wants to talk about the new Elie Wiesel website and the Elie Wiesel tattoo issue. The website is, of course, Elie Wiesel Cons the World, and the URL is www.eliewieseltattoo.com. So this is going to be my first adventure at talking about this issue. And it's a two-hour show. It's going to be on live from 5 to 7 on Wednesday. And it's at http://robrevere.com. That's http://robrevere.com. So I invite all my listeners to tune in if you can. And then it will also be archived later on Dr. Fetzer's blog at http://radiofetzer.blogspot.com. You can just look up Fetzer and you'll find these things. For those who don't know, Jim Fetzer is quite well known. He is a retired professor emeritus at the University of Minnesota Duluth, and he's had various radio programs over the last few years, and this is his latest one. He's had his earlier ones with other people, but he started out looking into JFK, and he's one of the major people focusing on the JFK assassination conspiracy theories, so to speak. And then when 9/11, after 9/11, he got into that heavily. And of course, he's retired now, so he can do all this. He was a professor of philosophy, basically. His philosophy is his field. He's a very intelligent man, but he's rather... some people might think he's slightly eccentric. His mind works very fast, and he's interested in everything. So this is why that comes across. But I have never talked to him personally, but I will be doing so. So we'll see how this goes. But he treats his guests very nicely. I listened to one program, so I'm looking forward to this, and I hope you will all tune in. And with that, I'm going to say good night. I hope I made my point. My point was that Elie Wiesel and Knight and all of this Holocaust literature is a part of the anti-German bias that is so prevalent that seems to never go away. And it is something that many people are really troubled by, and I'm one of them. So thank you for listening, and tune in again next week. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.